Oh, boy. Here we go. 9:13 on a Wednesday. I don't know if any of you caught it, but in the script it said Tuesday, 24th. So if anybody's confused right now, feel like they missed an appointment, it is Wednesday. You've been saved. I'll try to get the script right next
time.
Such
a beautiful day yesterday. Decided to do it over.
Yeah, exactly. Why not do it again? All over again. That's what the weeks feel like. You know, working here. We're excited today to mix up my routine. I'm luckily been chosen to sit with these three wonderful people on the roundtable this morning. If you don't know who I am, I'm David Giustini. You just heard me on Morning Edition. Same person, same voice. Now to our panelists. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. Good morning.
Good morning. Delighted to be here. Always fun to be here when you're hosting.
Yeah. Well, thank you. A lot of nice messages came through about me hosting, and I appreciate your sincerity, I believe. Now, Teresa, you've already done the panel with one of our other panelists out in the parking lot. That's Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly. How was that discussion out there?
Oh, it was fascinating, I must say. Running into Teresa is always so wonderful. Yes. I mean, within an instant, we have a great conversation.
Indeed.
Until the bus fired up, and then you had to come
in
the
building. And then we couldn't hear anything anymore, and it was very loud.
So
and
we had to come
like,
in and do it in the
yes.
microphone.
Last but certainly not least, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, and a man who corrected me to tell me what day it was, Robert Griffin. Bob, how you doing?
It's better to be a day closer to Friday than a day back. So.
Well, I'm always a day late and a dollar short.
I'm with
short.
You on that.
And David, everybody listening, remember it's Administrative Professional Day today, so say nice things the people you work with.
Yeah. Well, you're all wonderful. I just want to say that off the bat. So many great people actually here in WAMC, in fact,
yes.
working in our administration, getting the jobs done that nobody gets to witness or hear, but are so vital to the survival of the station. So thank you for that, Bob. Well, you can email us, join the discussion today at panel@wamc.org. What do you say we get the discussion underway? Big news, Senate has approved aid for Ukraine and Israel, sending it to Biden's desk. From the New York Times, the Senate voted overwhelmingly Tuesday night to give final approval to a $95.3 billion package of aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, sending it to President Biden and ending months of uncertainty about whether the United States would continue to back Kyiv in its fight against Russian aggression. The vote reflected resounding bipartisan support for the measure, which passed the House on Saturday by lopsided margins after a tortured journey on Capitol Hill, where it was nearly derailed by right-wing resistance. The Senate's action, on a vote of 79-18, provided a victory for the president, who had urged lawmakers to move quickly so he could sign it into law. And it capped an extraordinary political saga that raised questions about whether the United States would continue to play a leading role in upholding the international order and projecting its values globally. Our allies, quote, around the world have been watching Congress for the last 6 months and wondering the same thing. When it matters most, will Americans summon the strength to come together, overcome the centrifugal pull of partisanship, and meet the magnitude of the moment? The question asked by Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democrat of New York and the majority leader. Tonight, under the watchful eye of history, the Senate answers this question with a thunderous and resounding yes. In a statement minutes after the vote, President Biden said he would sign the bill into law, quote, and address the American people as soon as it reaches my desk so we can begin sending weapons and equipment to Ukraine this week. That's a big deal, something we've been waiting to see what would happen with, and now it has passed. How do you feel about it? Let's start with you, Vera Acarius-Kelly.
So I, as many of the listeners know, have been a strong supporter of Ukraine, and I'm honestly relieved that this bill has finally passed. I'm not thrilled with all elements of the bill, but I'm very relieved about the Ukraine aid. The artillery is already pre-positioned by the Pentagon in southern Poland, so once Biden signs, some of this material will arrive in Ukraine just hours later, and I think it will lift morale among the stressed Ukrainian troops, and it will probably dampen enthusiasm in Russia for an aggressive campaign in early summer, May, June, right, as was expected. So the most important aspect of this bill is that ATACMS will be delivered, which are missiles that can reach deep into Russian territory and can be used for targeted attacks of, you know, in areas that are occupied by the Russians in terms of their weapons deposits, their intelligence gathering sites. You know, so I'm overall very pleased with that. In Europe, the reaction is extremely positive. The French and the Germans are already talking about how they can supplement some of the some of this bill. You know, as they have delivered continuously, but not to the same amount and extent as the United States. So overall, I think the Europeans are uplifted. They feel that the United States is a strong supporter of the. Of the policy in Ukraine, and I think the advice to the Ukrainian, as far as I understand, is hold the Russians to where they are. Don't go into any crazy counteroffensive here. Just hold the Russians where they are, maybe push them back a little bit, but no sort of beyond the pale attacks. We'll see.
Bob?
So, yeah, a couple of points that sort of I think we should be talking about. One, just to sort of break down the where the money is. $61 billion went to Ukraine, $26.4 went to Israel, but also to Gaza, too, that there is aid packages there as well, and then $8.1 billion to the Indo-Pacific, and the majority of that going to Taiwan. There was also a provision, though, David, that we need to put on the table about TikTok, about the fact that the Senate passed and the president said he's going to sign this bill, which is going to force the showdown, I think, in the courts over what the future of TikTok is. And so there's certainly an area that is ripe for additional conversation. A couple points that I'll put on the table. And we can,
especially, Bob, right, when it comes to the security issues they say that we'll be facing if they keep it under Chinese control.
And the amount of personal data that is being basically vacuumed up and brought over to China in ways that is just an enormous security threat. I'm a big fan of Mark Warner, the senator from Virginia, and I listened with a lot of attention to some of his comments, and I thought he was spot on about the national security risk with TikTok. Couple other issues that I'd love to come back to. One is, what does this mean for the Freedom Caucus? Has the speaker finally figured out that sort of working across the aisle is more fruitful than working with the band of miscreants that the Freedom Caucus has become? And that raises sort of two other issues. One, this is just in time for the Ukrainians to deal with the Russian spring offensive, which has already started. So understand when Vera talks about timing on this, it's already late for the Ukrainian military. And I have to put this on the table for comment and interested in perception on this is when and how do GOP leaders, particularly if you think about in both the Senate and in the House, become so enamored and supportive of Putin and Russia? I mean, there's no other way to be viewing their position on Ukraine other than a flat out repudiation of what I thought was an American, pretty solid ideal of countering Russian aggression, and that's something that I think we really do need to talk about.
And don't seem to recognize the Cold War alliances revealing themselves,
and even folks in our own neighborhood, members of our congressional delegation in New York. I just really question, you know, what their motives are, are they going to be okay when Russia rolls into Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland? Are they ready for World War III, and are they going to own it?
You're listening to the Roundtable Panel on WAMC. It's 9:22 in the morning on a Wednesday. I say a Wednesday, Teresa, because I got it wrong earlier. You know, you're not having a good day when you get the day wrong itself. But we're going to improve that because Teresa is now going to enlighten us on her thoughts on the passage of this major legislation.
Thank goodness this got done, but it is late. But I think the politics of this are very interesting, the process that got us to yes. And it's a reminder of how the House and Senate and the administration are supposed to work, how governing is supposed to work in this country, which is in a bipartisan way. And I want to, you know, a word of praise for House Speaker Johnson, because he had a decision to make. And what he has done here, I think, is what has needed to be done for a long time, which is marginalize the far right, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, and understand that the way you do that, the way you dissipate their power, is by showing that you don't need them. And he, you know, he talks, there's a, he got together with a couple of his conservative members. They talked it through. He got some intelligence briefings that, by all accounts, about what's going on in Ukraine and Taiwan, and Israel, certainly. And it really alarmed him. And he said he, quote unquote, prayed on it and then made a decision to do what's right for the country. And he should be praised for that. But I also think it shows the importance of having skilled leadership in the Biden administration, who by all accounts have quietly, persistently continued to work with him to help him figure out a pathway through to this, and did it in a way that allowed him to hold enough of his membership together. And also, by all accounts, Senator Schumer showed some incredibly depth leadership and worked closely with Senator McConnell. And this is how it's supposed to work, because we've known for a long time that if the right bill went to the House and Senate floor, a majority of the members would vote yes. Mm-hmm. And it is late, but we need to see more of this. And hopefully this will become a pattern of marginalizing that far right. And we also have to keep in mind what fueled the far right, which was Donald Trump. Donald Trump, you know, them, first of all, they said, we're not going to pass this bill without a border agreement. Mm-hmm. Got the border agreement. It was strong. It was bipartisan. It was not what everybody wanted. It was not an immigration bill, but it was an agreement. And at the last minute, Trump comes in and blows it up. Mm-hmm. Trump's anti-Ukraine, anti-Ukraine, anti-Ukraine. Listening to J.D. Vance on the Senate floor last night, mm-hmm. and he, you know, he's auditioning, like Stefanik appears right. To be the vice presidential mm-hmm. candidate. The things he was saying about, you know, he's tired of hearing about World War II and we're beyond that. And mm-hmm. and just the lack of, Vera, you know this yeah. better than me, but the lack of situational awareness right. about the global stage. Mm-hmm. In any case, I think we need more of this. And I think the funding is essential. One last thing I'd like to hear you two mm-hmm. on. I have been astounded by Zelensky, the Ukrainian President Zelensky, and how strategic he has been and on point he has been in his comments, in his responses, in his immediate thank you, in the way he, when Trump says something and he's asked about it and it's untoward, he'll just say, well, have him come visit. I think he'll change his mind rather than attack. I mean, his, for somebody who comes into this with no political background, the way he has managed through this is astounding.
Yeah, I mean, he has done a really excellent job in terms of courting support, explaining, contextualizing his situation, demonstrating that Ukraine, especially to the Europeans, but also to the Americans, that Ukraine is like this major buffer state that protects Europe and the United States from basically being rolled over by the Russians. So he has done an exceptionally thoughtful job, and he doesn't always fall for the media tricks that right. Trump relies on, because he knows better. He knows he's not in position of power, but he knows he will lose if he counterattacks. So he just lets that go and works on other alliances, which he has done so effectively. The other thing, Teresa, I was actually going to ask you about, don't you think it's so interesting that Johnson worked very closely with senators of southern states who actually will benefit greatly from this right. bill? Because 75% of the money that goes into this bill actually goes to those states,
right.
creating jobs, producing, you know, weaponry and refreshing the United States weapons systems, and then exporting older materials. So this money mostly stays in the United States and strengthens our economy, interestingly enough. Most people think, oh, this is a huge gift to other countries. This is a huge gift to our economy, especially Republican states.
Right, right. And they really understood that. And a couple of the the members talked about it recently as if it was new news. But it's not new news, but it gives them a way to talk about it in a way that they can go back home. Right. Because there has been all of this far-right Trump rhetoric about questioning our interests in Ukraine, which I think is very uninformed, short-sighted, and dangerous. And I think McConnell, but not in a forceful way, tried to counter some of that. But I do think the economic angle is one that it's you should be able to get there on the substance of it. But, I mean, Bob, you know.
Yeah, wasn't it John Wayne Mullins? Was that the senator?
Right, exactly.
That sort of switched his vote because he realized that, that this was such a boost to the industry.
I mean, it's a win for him and his district, right? Or his region.
I mean, it's I also find it, let me start by admitting that I am not a J.D. Vance fan. But we need to come after we come back from break. We really need to talk about this new axis between Russia, Iran, and China. And he may want to ignore the history of World War II, but it's shaping up very similar ways.
He is Robert Griffin, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. And he is in conversation with Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Akarius-Kelly, and public policy and communication expert, Teresa Bourgeois. I'm David Gustina. You're listening to the Roundtable Panel. Email us. Tell us what you think about this legislation, panel at WAMC.org. I'm afraid we have to go over and speak with our English friends from the Beep. We'll be right back with more Roundtable right after this brief news breaklet. Boy, that makes you want to get up and dance, doesn't it?
There's a lot of dancing going
partners
on.
Partners being swung around in here. Do-si-do. What? I don't know. It's the faux pas. That's the music we're hearing
it's
right
now. It's the faux pas?
The faux pas.
That's the definition of my life.
The faux pas might have been not passing this legislation that we've been talking about. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC. I'm David Gustina, and we're back from our little break with Bob Griffin and Vera Akarius-Kelly and Teresa Bourgeois. We've been talking about the fact that the Senate voted overwhelmingly on Tuesday night to give final approval to the $95.3 billion package of aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, sending it to President Biden. The bipartisan bill includes, as Bob pointed out earlier, $60.8 billion for Ukraine, $26.4 billion for Israel, and humanitarian aid for civilians in conflict zones, including Gaza, and $8.1 billion for the Indo-Pacific region. You know, while you guys were talking about all this, and it was prompted by Vera saying, you know, Europe is very happy with this deal. How do you think Americans are looking at this deal? I know it's we're a divided country, obviously, but you know, I look at the headline and I see in the headline it doesn't mention the aid to Gaza. It says Israel, and you know, we have complicated issues right now across the country. How does this look, for example? How do the Americans look at it for President Biden? You know, how does he fare in getting this deal done?
Well, I think you're right that there isn't enough detailed information about what this bill actually does and how it does it. I think it's a headline. It's information about total sums. We've talked a little bit about the kinds of weaponry is going to be purchased or delivered and who benefits mostly, namely Americans in the South in certain factories. But we don't really know any specific details on the humanitarian aid, for example. We know there's some allocation towards Gaza. We know there's allocation towards Sudan. And there are some other crisis points around the world that get some additional money. But how it will be applied, how it will be distributed, how it will reach the populations, we really don't know very much about it at all. And it would be very interesting to find out because, as we all know, we have, you know, Bob and I talked about it, Will we make it through graduation here in the Capital Region without student protests related to the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the ongoing war and the demands for ceasefires we see at some of the more exclusive or premier institutions in this country? We see encampments now among students. On my campus at Siena, we've had so far educational gatherings, a talk by pre-med students about the medical situation in Gaza and the crisis that the medical staff experiences there. And then we have had some fundraisers for the Palestinian Children's Health Fund, where people have done bake sales and sent money on a regular basis to this organization and nonprofit to help support children in war and suffering. So, but not too far from here, we've had some very serious exchanges. Mostly, I would say, the students want a recognition that aid to Israel should be conditioned. We should have an immediate ceasefire, and major institutions that are very wealthy should disclose how they earn their interest and based on what investments they earn, they earn their interest, and if they're in fact collaborating or working with any Israeli corporations. This sort of reminds me of, the South African divestment approach. And I think students have a good plan here trying to figure this out. You know, where does our money go? Are we officially supporting a ceasefire agreement? You know, what is our conversation on campuses around this subject? I was not very pleased with the arrest of the students, 113, I think, at Columbia, and calling in the police. I think that just heats up the scenario. Teresa, you and I talked about the issue of maybe outside agitators arriving. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's, one of the concerns that people expressed was that there were, who knows what really happened here, but there were people on campus in the encampment at Columbia University, and some of them were Jewish students, and there are a range of people who were concerned about the human rights issues and the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and they were doing this together, peaceably. But then there were some voices, and some people say they were outside voices, maybe they were not, that it became anti-Semitic. It became very dangerous. Some of the Jewish students felt at risk, felt fear. And so the issue is, can these students who have concerns about what's going on with the people of Gaza, primarily children, women and children who are being killed, who aren't getting enough food, who humanitarian aid is going into, can they have their voices heard in a way that does not have the Jewish students on campus feel at risk and or be at risk? And that's the thing that I think needs to be addressed. But was sending in police to break up the encampment the right thing to do? Well, what it seems to have done is just create encampments all over the country, mm-hmm. right, in solidarity. But I think that one of the things, as I was reading the Times, I think, had editorials from mm-hmm. university campuses all over the country. And the common underlying message is there's not enough dialogue between the administration, the faculty, and the students. And in that just because we are pro-Palestinian and want a ceasefire and humanitarian relief does not mean that we are anti-Semitic, mm-hmm. that we... So I think that and,
the situation. I mean, so let's frame Columbia a little bit differently, though. Okay, it's a private institution, so the request for the police to come on campus was made by the administration for what they thought were violations of the law. Mm-hmm. So
and including by some outside people.
Well within their right. I will also note that I am much less sympathetic to the encampments than the two of you. I am completely supportive of free speech, and I think the idea of of supporting the Palestinian cause, it doesn't. I'm making a hash of this. I have enormous issues with the way Netanyahu has carried out the war. Okay, I feel already that there should have been a cease in hostilities, and we should be in rebuilding right now. With that said, I mean, there's truth about what Hamas is versus what it isn't, and my belief is that it's a terrorist organization. So what I think campuses struggle with is how to have a dialogue about the fact that there are two valid sides here. But what's occurring, though, is that there's a feeling that some students don't feel safe on campus. It's not just students, faculty, and staff. And when the rabbi for the university, for Columbia, sends a message out saying, go home for Passover because it's not safe here, I think the administration has a responsibility to act in that situation.
But I guess I'm old enough to remember Kent State, so to bring in the police is
scary.
And I am pro police. I worked in Boston with the police very carefully. I mean, very. I want to talk about this very carefully, is what I'm saying in my mind, because to be clear, I am pro police. I think they have an almost impossible job. They are asked to do too many different things, not just law enforcement, but they are asked to be, any case. So I am absolutely pro police, but it is a very precarious situation to be put in. Mm-hmm. And are there ways to negotiate these kinds of situations that are learning experiences for students that dampen the temperature? Palestinian students shouldn't feel unsafe on campus. Jewish students, no faculty. People shouldn't be afraid to walk around on campus. De-escalate that is the question.
Yeah, so, but be careful with the Kent State, because it wasn't police in Kent State that was the shooting.
Guard.
It was the National Guard. But that's a really important distinction. That's a military organization versus police. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't elements of militarization within NYPD, but that is a distinction I think is important.
But it puts them in a terrible position. I mean, the question is, what's the right way to de-escalate?
One of the things that I agree with is that, we're dealing with a lot of young people, and they're for the first time in their lives are insisting this is a political issue that they really believe in, and they want to take a stand, and it's important to them. And I think it is wrongheaded to confront them in the most aggressive and hostile ways. So I would highly recommend that universities reflect on that style.
Could be one of the most important courses they take at the university.
Right.
So I'm offering
lesson.
A Middle East politics class in the fall. So I'm going to talk about these things, right? So we have students interested in this. They want to learn more about the conflict and why it is and how it is, who all is suffering and why countries have certain agendas, right? So one of the things that I find really troubling is that administrations sometimes make decisions more in isolation than in consultation on college campuses. And that can happen at private institutions where administrators, the president of Columbia was just under pressure, was trying
that
to demonstrate, right, that she was not going to permit anti-Semitism on her campus. She is of Egyptian origin, so she felt particularly pressured to demonstrate that she was not going to let the situation get out of hand. She made a poor choice. She mentioned faculty under investigation by name. Why would you do that? Why don't you deal with that in consultation with your faculty committees? Why don't you do that with your administrative teams? Why don't you call student leaders into your office and consult with them what they really want, and then tell them what you're concerned about and figure out a path forward? Administrators are mostly concerned about is donors and reputations. And they need to get beyond that. And these are educational institutions where there are opportunities to educate and reach out.
Let's pause just for a moment. We're going to take a quick break. We'll get back to this discussion in just one moment. Hey, you're listening to The Roundtable. It's 9:47 on a Wednesday, and we are in deep discussion right now, and serious discussion, with public policy and communication expert Teresa Bourgeois, Siena College professor of comparative politics Vera Akarius-Kelly, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University of Albany, Robert Griffin. I'm David Gustina, filling in for Joe Donahue. And you just heard the faux pas. That playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. And you can join our discussion today at panel@wamc.org. I see one letter has come in. Before I read that, though, I want to let you kind of finish up where you're going here. Teresa, you remember what you were going to say?
Yeah, well, I actually want to hear from Bob. One of the things, the president of Colombia and any of these presidents, we're not in the room hearing all the different factors that go into their decision. So I think that we have to give them, you know, some space on that. And also, she had just come out of a congressional hearing. The other thing that worries me is I watch a lot of Fox News to try to understand what's going on in the world. And if you listen to Fox, you would think all these campuses are on fire, that they Jewish students are completely unsafe, the faculty. I think that they are adding fuel to this fire. I think that some of the Republicans are adding fuel to this fire. Rather than trying to de-escalate the situation, they're doing just the opposite. But Bob,
I think that this plays well into the narrative of the presidential election, to be honest. And if I'm a GOP strategist, if I can continue to inflame the situation and say, listen, you know, at like the University of Michigan, if I can pull off 5,000 student votes from Biden in a tight election, that's going to be enormously impactful. So I do think there's with a certain degree of cynicism that this is being trumpeted, not because some of our GOP leadership, including Stefanik, you know, really cares about the issue, but more it's a political football. A finer point, though, on just putting a period on the earlier discussion about the passage of the aid. If you think about the buckets where the aid went, that reflects, I think, the biggest threat to our national safety and security. So when you think about Ukraine, you think about Israel, the Middle East, and you think about the Indo-Pacific, particularly Taiwan. That's where I think we are closer to an armed conflict than we have been in literally decades. With that said, back to the situation just about the protests and where we are with Israel. A couple of points. One, I want to remind everybody that you can't forget the genesis of this war, and that was the unprovoked October 7th attack. Okay, so you need to go back to that. The other element for us in the Sunnis are, you know, we're state agencies, we're open campuses, different than Columbia, different than Siena. With that said, though, freedom of speech does have limitations.
And responsibilities.
And this is what I will certainly come back to time and time again. You don't have the right to intimidate. You don't have the right to surround and harass. And part of, I think, all of our responsibilities to our students is how do you create a dialogue that allows all of these issues to be raised in ways that allow students and honestly the faculty and staff to make informed personal decisions.
So we have mission statements at institutions. We have values that we stand for. And I can just speak for Siena what our values are. But that is the parameter around which we operate. So that is why we can have a conversation between Muslim students and Jewish students and Christian students and, you know, Hindu students and whoever else attends. And we have had those conversations. And that is a framework around which you can have much more extensive conversations if you have if you abide by what your values are. Now, you know, one of the interesting things is that we have more coverage frequently on intimidation of Jewish students or Jewish community members, where we have less coverage on when this happened consistently to Muslim students across the country, right? We had Trump's effort at the Muslim ban. We had the Brown student who was stabbed and paralyzed in Burlington, Vermont. We had the young boy who was murdered by, often these are sort of...
In Chicago.
Often these are people who are just responding. And, you know, they're not, it's not a Jewish on Muslim or Muslim on Jewish attack most often. It's most often white males that are deranged and have anger issues and are vicious and have access to weapons. That is also an issue that hasn't really been portrayed publicly very much. It's frequently white supremacists that are engaging in those attacks. And I think we as educational institution have a responsibility to peel the onion and figure out what is really going on and who all is involved and what political motivations they have and what purposes they pursue. And I think to just simply portray it as, you know, students are out of control, certain campuses are, you know, need to get the police. And, you know, we as educators are not doing our jobs then at institutions. As educators, as administrators, as staff members, it is our responsibility to make everybody feel comfortable on campus, to reach out to our colleagues, and to offer opportunities for dialogue. And I think that is what we need to do more of, instead of pay attention to, you know, hot button issues that are posted on social media and then sort of take a discussion completely out of context and let it be used for political agendas.
What
and
do I you think, listeners? Panel at WAMC.org. Check in with us. Panel at WAMC.org. Teresa.
I think it goes back to David's original question, too, about what does he think the public thinks about this. And we've been focusing on what's happening on college campuses. But remember, there was a... I think this requires public education because there's a group of people, Trump and Fox and that group, who really want to, you know, say, well, why are we giving money away when we have all these needs in the United States? Why are we, you know, why are we giving money to for public servants running agencies in Ukraine when we don't, you know, have the money here? Why aren't we protecting our own borders when we're giving money to protect the borders in Ukraine? And I think that that requires a just like there was a bipartisan vote, we need a bipartisan voice explaining that to the people, that this investment of this amount of money is far less than it would cost us if we don't do this because of the repercussions. If Ukraine does fall to Russia, if they continue the march through Ukraine as they want to do.
You mean long-term thinking, Teresa?
Yeah, broader thinking. And also, but I will say there's one part of the money that I am deeply concerned about. I do think it's imperative in the Palestinian question to distinguish between Hamas and the Palestinians. Not all Palestinians are Hamas. And many of these folks are children. And one of the things that they did do is require that no funding can go to UNRWA, the United Nations group that's in the Palestinian areas.
They still are, but there's
so little funding.
Yeah.
But they were the core infrastructure that provided hospital medical care and humanitarian relief. Mm-hmm. And there are many other, 40 or more other private agencies, but they relied on the infrastructure. And for the U.S. to walk away from that, I understand I'm aware of the politics of it, but the reality of it is that that will increase the suffering. And so there needs to be some way, if it's not through the U.S., some way to replenish those fundings because they are the humanitarian delivery system.
1 minute.
Yeah, it's just really interesting the comparison between the two borders. And there's a big difference in my mind between tanks and bombers and a military coming over the border versus people who are trying to come here to empty our bedpans, pick our produce, work in our slaughterhouses, and do jobs that we don't want to. So, I mean, that's that false equivalency that just drives me absolutely crazy
and
about
there was
border
the bill,
security.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was a solution, right?
They did, mm-hmm. and Trump didn't want it because he thought it would hurt his campaign.
So I wanted to say Hamas is despicable, and many people in Gaza have expressed their disgust with Hamas and their inability to lead people and to provide better opportunities. I mean, there are more and more stories. If you pay close attention to what comes is reported out of Gaza, many, many Palestinians really hate Hamas. And so now they're being held responsible and they can't get out and they're suffering, and that has to end.
She is Vera Acarius Kelly. We've heard from Robert Griffin and Teresa Bourgeois, and you are listening to the Roundtable Panel on WAMC. You can join our discussion by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. I'm David Giustina. Next up, don't you go anywhere. It's the man. Yes, the man. Uncle Grumpy himself, Mr. Ray Graff.
Hey,
with
Ray.
The news. I've got to say, guys, I like this music. It's the Faux Pas. It's posted online, our playlist, that is, at wamc.org/roundtable. It seems a little too upbeat, though, for the discussion going on right now. We're having a serious discussion on the roundtable this morning.
Well, you know what, Dave?
Teresa.
If they played the Faux Pas on campuses as part of the demonstration, it would lighten things up, get people talking to
each really
other.
Could.
I'm sorry, I totally
Maybe it was a faux
you.
Pas that we played it during the discussion. It all ties together, you see.
I totally interrupted you. I'm so sorry.
You know what, Teresa? That was a faux pas. And Teresa Bourgeois faux pasing over there. Then we have Vera Caris Kelly. And they were very involved in discussion while we were away mm-hmm. listening to Raymond. And Robert Griffin is here. He is also in the middle of this discussion, kind of literally in between Teresa and Vera. And now we get to the letters. We have letters from Lisa. Here we go. My niece is a grad student at Yale who has been protesting. She claims that not only are Jewish students not feeling targeted, many Jewish students are taking part in the protests. She claims the protests are peaceful and not being accurately depicted on the news. That's Lisa. Anyone want to respond?
Well, it's a highly politicized environment, so everybody interprets it to their benefit, I think. And that's part of the complication on college campuses. Because I do believe that certain students are being selected for interviews because maybe they're louder, they're more interesting to talk to, or they represent what's perceived as a typical position. But it does require...
And the definition of news is conflict.
Yes, I mean, you know, it makes for a story, right? So if you dramatize it, you have better, you know, you have more interest in it. So, yeah, I think we don't have the full picture of what's really going on college campuses. We haven't spoken to enough people. We haven't really listened in well enough. I think we are being, you know, manipulated in some ways by emotional agendas.
Yeah, I mean, college campuses are like cities. I mean, mm-hmm. if you think about
That's
it,
right.
you're talking about, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20,000 students on campus. So the idea that there's that this is a monolith, that everybody is one way or other, is absolutely false. I think the media picks and chooses depending on what their position is. I mean, it reminds me of the fact that you know, you see media go into one diner in some nowhere hole in mm-hmm. Iowa, talk to one person, and all of a sudden
no
extrapolate.
Offense, Iowa.
Yeah, no offense, Iowa.
No, it was offensive. It's okay. but it's
you meant to say it, little it, diner.
This is
not representative.
It's
is
not.
What you're
it is no. absolutely not representative. In mm-hmm. and like the conflict itself, it is so nuanced. Mm-hmm. And it's a world of gray.
And we don't have a lot of nuance in our politics.
I will say
plain
that
and simple.
No.
NPR story, Debbie Beecher, I'm quoting Debbie Beecher, a sociology professor at Barnard College, which is part of Columbia, told Morning Edition Tuesday that campus feels relatively safe and peaceful, unlike the portrayals of it on social media. She described the pro-Palestinian encampment as a, quote, place of sharing and community building.
And here from Matthew, dear panel, per the New York Times, pro-Palestinian Jewish students, protesters prepared Seder on the first night of Passover in the tent encampment. You are falsely characterizing the peaceful protests as threatening. Where were you in the 60s during Vietnam War protests? Were they justified?
Well, I don't think we were, you know.
I was one, so I think I have a pass on that.
But Teresa and I certainly have been speaking up on behalf of students' rights to protest and that it was not aggressive and violent.
No, I think it's very, very important. Maybe in a Pollyannish way, I think it's wonderful that they're speaking up. I think that, and in some cases, they will make what some people perceive as mistakes. You know, they might not say the right words, they might not do it right. But I do think that it's important that their voices be heard. I think they need to do it in a peaceful way. And as Bob has said, it has to be responsible. And you can reiterate your...
No, you put your finger right on it. And if we're going to draw at the historical analogy, what I don't want to see with the protests is exactly what happened in the Vietnam War, with SDS becoming increasingly more violent in both their actions and rhetoric. And that's where, I mean, that's where the real danger,
And we don't have really strong examples in our, you know, in some of our prior leadership and certainly the prior president and currently, you know, trying to sort of interject messages that are quite encouraging of violent means sometimes, you know, so confrontational, aggressive. And I think this is so unhelpful. When you're trying to bring
people
together.
Well, and you've got to put it in the context of a presidential election year.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how are we going to see that? It's going to ratchet up, not down.
Yep.
And for some, they'll think it, I think for the Republicans, far-right Republicans, for the Trump wing of the Republican Party, I think they might find it's in their interest. And if you watch Fox News, they are fueling the fire. I think, you know, I've been listening to President Biden. He's supposed to speak today. But one of the things, you know, he's talked about the importance of freedom of speech, voices be heard, but done in a proper way. And, you know, it's a tough needle to thread. Mistakes will be made. But it is important to hear young people's voices, and this will be lessons of a lifetime for them.
This letter came from Mark, and he's commenting on what Vera had to say. I think this is really interesting. Vera is right. I had the good fortune to attend a college that defused the post-Kent State moratorium by chartering buses for all students who so desired to visit their representatives in Washington to express their views. I've urged my alma mater to respond to today's crisis by having something akin to Boys or Girls State, where the students of competing views negotiate the peace. A real learning opportunity.
I mean, hands-on experiences, interactions with the real world. This is where it's at, right? Community engagement. So you don't just read texts in an abstract way, but you actually bring them to the current situation and link the two. That is what students need, and that's what students want. And I think the idea to sort of, you know, allow students to actually visit the Capitol and figure out how policies are made is one of those ideas. You know, there's so many options that we have as educators to connect students to what the world is like. You know, we might all have our wishes and ideal concepts of what the world would look like, but there are obstacles we need to work our way through or overcome. And that is what students should learn from this.
And I think we have to remember that there are generational impacts for what's going on in Israel right now and in Gaza, both for the people there and all around the world, just like there's generational impacts for what's going to become of the situation in Ukraine, which is why we want to be involved. And so this is going to ripple throughout the rest of their lives, these young people, and the fact that they're engaged in the discussion. And it's a real clear question about what's the right humanitarian response. Yeah. It's critically important. Also, this might not be right, but I was thinking just now about Robert F. Kennedy was in Indianapolis. He was there with John Lewis, who ultimately became Congressman John Lewis, my hero, the day that Martin Luther King was killed. And he got up and spoke there in Indianapolis. And while there were riots all over the country, there were not riots in Indianapolis that night. Mm-hmm. And because he spoke of peace and that we needed to, it was one of the great speeches. And so I think that is just a small anecdote about how dialogue, if done in the right way, you can either escalate or de-escalate.
Well, and think about it in the context of right now, when you have, in I don't know what other historical equal there is to this, a former president, since he's lost, actively campaigning and being covered right along with the president who is current president, President Biden, and having that echo chamber constantly coming at you. Mm-hmm. You see the power of a former president. That bully pulpit is everything. It changes the discussion, and that ripples around the world.
His bully tone, though. It's not, you know, it's a bully tone is the way he uses the bully pulpit. And that, I think, that coarsening of our dialogue is what's so disturbing to me.
What about Judith? The letters are flowing in, by the way, now. At WAMC.org, Judith says, I'm struck by the difference between the outcry about anti-Semitism, which, from what I can tell, since it has never been described, is verbal harassment, and Islamophobia, including the many years of suppression of pro-Palestinian anti-Zionist voices on campus. On many campuses, anti-Zionism has been defined as anti-Semitism, even though many anti-Zionists are Jewish. No news report that I have heard makes it clear what constitutes anti-Semitism in the current brouhaha. I offer all of the above as a very proud pro-Semitic anti-Zionist Jew. That's from Judith.
This is a very complicated issue because I have Jewish friends who would argue this situation quite differently. So I think there's so many variations within. I know people who say you can't. I mean, you are a Zionist if you're Jewish. So I mean, you know, we all have different interpretations based on our positioning, All I can say is I think we need to have more of a dialogue to sort of pull those aspects apart and understand where we all position ourselves and why we do so, to learn more.
Yeah, Vera, you make, I think, a really important point. I mean, even the definition of what a Zionist is. So, I mean, historically, if you want to talk Zionism, you know, Ben-Gurion was a Zionist. Ben-Gurion is sort of viewed as almost a George Washington equivalent of, for the state of Israel. But this is where I think this also shows the complexity of the situation and why it's so dangerous to rely on labels and slogans, especially not understanding what some of the underpinnings of those slogans and labels are.
Well, socialism has often been equated to communism by many in the Republican right.
Well, listen to Trump. I mean, he accuses the left of everything. What does he call them? Communists, socialists, Nazis, and it's like, no. I mean, that's sort of bought by folks that follow him without really getting into what each one of those definitions really means.
So when I start teaching in my Middle East class, I actually when we talk about Israel and Palestinian communities, we actually often begin with the 1880s with Theodor Herzl and the movement migration of Jews to the region, right? And so we take a more historical context and sort of look at original texts and arguments that are used, and then, of course, look at the Balfour Declaration, the role of the British occupation in the region, and then go from there. So with that context, you understand significantly more, but I sometimes think that people have only elements of information, bits and pieces of information, put a puzzle together that doesn't quite fit. And it's a very complex situation, historically, politically, ideologically, socially, culturally. And so all of it needs to be put together. And I think it's extremely difficult, and particularly so in a hostile environment where you might feel that one group or another might secretly tape you or post some information about what you said out of context. So this is challenging, to say the least.
Well, Ed has something to say. He wrote to the panel, and he says, and maybe, Bob, you could start by answering this. How do you make sure that aid going to Gaza does not end up in the hands of Hamas? Whether we like it or not, Hamas is the de facto government in Gaza. On another matter, why is no one investigating who is funding the protests on our college campuses?
So let me answer the first. I think that the challenge that our administration has right now is that there isn't a legitimate government in Gaza to be able to turn to. And even if you think about the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, there's enormous issues of trust So this, I think, has really negatively impacted our ability to start to create, I think, pipelines that should have already been in place, that we should have already been bringing a lot more aid into Gaza, but not having someone to be able to receive that and then be able to trust that that money is being used correctly. And part of the question is going to have to be answered as sort of post-mortem of this whole thing is, how much aid was taken away from the people of Gaza in order to build the military infrastructure that Hamas used? So I mean, you don't want to replicate that, but at the same time, you don't want people starving or not having proper medical care. These are all questions that are going to have to get answered. And this is also where, you know, back to the point was made earlier, Teresa, about this is where I would say the UN should and could play a role. They're going to have to regain trust, whether, you know, that the feeling right now is that they are not a trusted agent. And I think that's also adding to the mm-hmm. problem.
But this is a question, not a statement,
sure,
because I don't know. Were they, as part of the Netanyahu government strategy, were they delegitimized because then it takes out some of the infrastructure there, or is there a real problem with them?
I think there's probably a little bit of column A, column B. I don't think I look askance at a lot of Netanyahu policies because I can't help but be cynical about the fact that he's trying to keep himself out of jail and retain power at all costs, including the freedoms of the people of Israel. If you think about what he was even trying to do to undermine the court system, so I'm very, very cynical of anything coming out of Netanyahu's cabinet in position. At the same time, I think there are enough points to point to with the UN that would raise concerns about how aid has been used.
Because I think, and again, I don't know. This is the one thing I wondered about, because in any large organization, there are always going to be some people with views different than the core views of the organization, right?
Right.
And who are employed there, and particularly in such a difficult, challenging situation as Gaza. And that's what I've wondered for a long time, because certainly this is a core Netanyahu talking point, a team talking point. But they are the humanitarian infrastructure delivery system, or they were. And the other delivery systems relied on their infrastructure, and they were the hospital infrastructure as well, right, which is really
right.
Broken down. And so if not them, what's the plan to replace them? And I think President Biden and Antony Blinken from the beginning were saying, all right, what's the plan the day after? What's mm-hmm. the plan the day after you stop dropping bombs? What's the plan? And they've been saying that from the beginning. And I don't think there's a real answer yet from Netanyahu.
Now, Teresa, you brought this up before we even came on this morning, which is this other question about who's investigating the funding. Who's funding the protests on college campuses? I haven't seen any stories on this myself. I don't know if there's legitimacy to that or not.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything on a central funder or organizations that specifically fund this across the country. I mean, we do know that universities are relying on major funders, such as, that's why we saw Kraft, when Kraft made his comment as a graduate, I think, of Columbia, right?
Yep. Yeah, Bob Kraft,
and he's invested
Patriots.
Millions of dollars in the institution by building a Jewish center of studies and all. I mean, millions and millions of dollars he spent, and now he's saying he will no longer donate to Columbia because he's so upset about the protests. That information we do have on the big funders. We have not seen a big funder behind the encampments.
Yeah, there's been a percolating speculation mm-hmm. that there's some similarity among the campuses, and some of this sprung up so quickly. Is there some, you know, hand in this to be fueling it? And I don't know the answer to it.
I view the question. I mean, I'm always interested in seeing how the money flows, because mm-hmm. if you want to understand sort of the silent hand, follow the money. At the same time, though, it's a wonderful way to cast aspersion on any group to say that you're a cat's paw or a pawn for somebody else, and that's the, you know, that's the villainization of George Soros. You know that
there is
hear.
No money from George Soros.
Not in this situation.
Yes, but I wanted to say.
But if
I agree with you.
But you hear, you hear groups that have legitimate political positions being ascribed to just being drone, you know, mindless drones of somebody else.
Right. It must be funded by somebody, and it must be this way, and therefore, and then you pick your, you know, supposed targets. Right. That's a political, you know, operative's game. That's what's done. Right. You just point out where the divisions lie, and therefore there must be big sponsors behind it. We don't have that information. Maybe we will find out something, but we don't have that public information.
5 minutes before we have to go to the Beeb, and I want to get one more letter in here and get your reaction. This is from Pat. Mm. As I see it, the inherent anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic views of these white Christian nationalists makes them unlikely to care who wins that war, and also unlikely to go to campus protests. If anything, Israel should be self-supporting. Our military assistance to Israel just makes the USA look bad.
All I can say, one of the most interesting things is always, to me, the evangelical support for Israel. It's not that the evangelicals really care about Israel at all. They're just waiting for the end of the world and their rise to heaven, right? That's what they're waiting for.
The rapture.
The rapture, right? So it's so interesting to me who allies with whom and for what reasons. So, you know, the sort of support structure, you know, they're always these self-interested elements involved in this particular issue. So the evangelicals in some ways have their position. Then, you know, we have free speech activists, and then we have, I mean, you can keep going and going on the agendas that are out there related to aid to Israel.
Except I would push back respectfully and say that the alliance with Israel is incredibly important. When you start to think about our needs to counterbalance Iran, but let's not fool ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, we consider the Saudi Arabians as quote, unquote, allies,
right.
But when you even look at their own pedagogy in their
right.
schools, it's vehemently anti-American. Okay,
absolutely.
So if you're going to talk about why is Israel such a, you know, why do we support it so strongly, it's because of the geopolitical situation in the mm-hmm. Middle East,
but isn't that sort of a little bit relying on tradition, because we have seen some changes under Netanyahu and the current Netanyahu government. They are not our democratic allies as we used to think of them. And the Saudis, while I agree with you 100%, they have their own agendas, you know. And they, after all, sent most of the 9/11 attackers, if I may point that out, and they did not suffer the consequences of that. But, you know, we constantly make new and different alliances. And in fact, the Israelis and the Saudis were trying to, I mean, part of the reason we think Hamas attacked Israel on October 6th was because the Israelis and the Saudis were in negotiation for a peace agreement. And that is, you know, a major development.
And the Iranians didn't want that.
Right? And the Iranians didn't want that. And, certain, you know, it would have changed the dynamics in the entire region. And that was one of the motivating factors for this assault.
And this is where the complexity of the region. So so you've got the whole Sunni-Shiite issue with even schisms within the Muslim world. You talk about changing alliances. I think... The Netanyahu's relationship, particularly with the Obama and Biden presidencies, is particularly strained.
Yes.
But then you also have situations like, you know, the changes that have gone on in Turkey, okay, with the sense of how Erdogan has changed Turkey from what I consider to be on a wonderful trajectory to where it is right now. So yeah, I mean things the alliances and relationships do shift.
Except for I want to point out that Erdogan just lost all the major cities in elections, and the end of Erdogan can be called now.
I'm not ready to go
on the record saying in a few years Erdogan is done.
Well, I mean, yeah, wait long enough. He's an old man.
No,
so,
I mean
that's a good
his presidential election is coming up, I think, in 2028, so he'll be done by then.
But question, you can still be a friend and an ally of Israel and not be a fan of the Netanyahu government.
Yes,
though, I
you
mean,
can.
I think you need to distinguish. I saw
Very
that
important.
Speaker Pelosi yesterday called for his resignation. So I think you have to, there's a distinction between being a friend and an ally of Israel, which we are, and not necessarily of the Netanyahu.
Yeah. And you can be a friend of basically human rights and elevate human rights and just human decency.
And I
not
think be anti-Semitic.
And that is what we should be focusing on.
Well, how much of Netanyahu's personal and political troubles are involved in some of the motivation here?
Well, it's keeping him out of jail.
Yeah.
Potentially.
You are listening to the Roundtable panel on WAMC. That was Bob Griffin. Before that, Vera Akiris Kelly. And before that, Teresa Bourgeois. I'm David Gustina. The Roundtable is what you're listening to. You can email us at panel@wamc.org whenever you want, but it's usually good during the show, so we have something to read. panel@wamc.org. While we wait for something to read, we'll send you to the Beeb. Coming up on 10:34, you are listening to the Roundtable on WAMC. I'm David Gustina. Lucky you. We're here with Vera Akiris Kelly, Teresa Bourgeois, and Robert Griffin. We have a letter from Joel, and it's sort of stark and to the point. And I'll get Bob, I'll get you to react first here to this. Joel says, so let me get this straight. America is going to provide billions in military aid for Israel to continue its horrific war in Gaza and at the same time provide billions in aid for relief of the victims of that war. Truly, this is insanity. Bob?
Yeah, I mean, and this ties back to the initial conversation we had about foreign aid. And the truth of the matter is that the aid that we're sending to Israel is as much about Hezbollah and countering Iran. Israel is fighting a proxy war for us right now against Iran. That's why you've seen the combat that's been going on in Syria. But this is also trying to thwart Russian aggression, movement into the Middle East through Syria. This is also, frankly, why we're funding Ukraine, why we're funding Taiwan. Is our foreign policy is that we send money and weapons to other people to fight our wars for us.
Do the American people recognize some of this?
I think it's very complicated because people don't really think about the connections between Iran, Russia, North Korea,
North Korea.
You know, we just see all the drones flooding the war zones that are made in Iran, for example, that the Russians use against. I mean, so the weapons systems flow, and we're trying to prevent. I mean, one of the arguments is, why do we send all this money?
Yeah.
We want to not have U.S. military personnel fight that war in the future. And that is one of the reasons that is always given, right? We are engaged in a variety of proxy wars. That is correct.
We're defending the Ukrainian-Russian border because we don't want to have to defend our own border.
Mm-hmm. Mixed in with all this, of course, is this protest that we're talking about. And this letter that came in from Jean, I think many people feel this way. And I can't say that I don't have some of this in my mind as well. I've been hearing for months that the situation is in Gaza is complicated. Yes, it is complicated historically and politically. However, on a human level, witnessing asymmetric warfare and the mass killing of innocent civilians makes it a simple issue.
It is in that sense that we have, it is a human requirement to support the civilian population in Gaza, to get food in, to get water in, to get medical care in. And when UNRWA was unfunded and when World Central Kitchen workers were killed.
Right.
And they pulled out.
That sort of weakened, if not destroyed, the necessary infrastructure to disseminate water, food, and medical care. it is a catastrophic situation. And the longer we wait in addressing that, the more dead children suffering from hunger and lack of water and lack of medical care we will see. And it is absolutely essential to address that issue today.
I would also add, though, if I could, that that situation, though, is not just in Gaza.
We walk
sure. down Central Ave right now and look at the situation with the homeless, with the addicted, with children not having enough to eat. So I like the idea of, you know, thinking globally, but you can act right now locally to also address some of the same concerns.
And they're not mutually exclusive.
We have a lot of money in this country. We have very, very wealthy people in this country. We have the infrastructure to help people here and elsewhere. The same as, you know, we have an ongoing situation in Sudan. We're finally getting some money for humanitarian support to Sudan. It is catastrophic there as well.
And almost no one is paying attention.
Nobody is paying attention to that one either. And we have similar images to what we see in Gaza, but we don't see them. We don't even see enough pictures from Gaza because we don't have journalists in there that can report because journalists have been targeted.
Mm-hmm. You know, not allowed.
And not allowed to enter, yep.
By the Israelis.
Before we leave this topic entirely, there's a because we started with the legislation that got passed,
yeah.
and we've gotten into this conversation. However, there is a part of that legislation that will impact a lot of people who probably don't pay attention to politics at all, and those are the TikTok users. And this is right up your bailiwick there, Robert Griffin, because, Bob, you know about security, and one of the arguments here is that identities will be stripped, the Chinese government will be privy to a lot of information that we don't want them to have. We know that this there's going to probably be a lawsuit, and it's going to end up in the courts. You mentioned that earlier. But what is it about this? It looks like we could be without TikTok.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's some incredibly complex and important First Amendment questions that are going. This is going to end up in the Supreme Court. With that said, though, there are masses of personal data. If you're on TikTok, you need to be aware that that your personal data is being made available to the Chinese government. They are basically vacuuming up huge amounts of information, and it's in my mind a real clear and present danger to our national security.
But we already know that Cambridge Analytica back in 2016, right. you know, sucked all the Facebook information out of all the Americans.
Yep, mm-hmm. yep. But you know, you start to think about it, is that What the Chinese infrastructure, the infrastructure of the Chinese intelligence in their military, is now being able to put together a more comprehensive profile, not just of maybe somebody who owns a security clearance. Okay, as somebody who had a security clearance and all of my information was stripped out because they hacked the OMB, the federal government. What bothered me more was the access in the ability to make a connection to my wife, to my children, to my other family members. And that's where you start to see the ability to start to put pressure, okay? That's where pressure becomes applied. So giving a more comprehensive picture of what the likes and dislikes are and how these relationship works. And that is exactly what the Chinese are using this information for. I'll also note that there was a Texas plan, the idea of Oracle holding America's data. And this is something that never came to fruition.
As far as we know.
Right.
But the bill says, the language of the bill, as I understand it, says that they have a year to sell it.
9 months.
Nine months. Yeah. But the question is, would the Chinese allow the algorithms to be used? And can you really protect the data or not? But I think this whole issue of data privacy, we could do 3 hours on that, and we'd need Fran Berman here. She'd be great on it, right? But People don't think about the fact that they are not the customer, they are the product. Because for these, the wealth building is in selling the data. Just like whether it's a Fitbit or TikTok, or we had another story today on GM and smart drivers collecting your insurance rates are affected by data they collect, which you sign away the rights to in a way that you don't really know. But I think that people need to, and there's a huge amount of money being spent on lobbying by TikTok to preserve TikTok, and you see the ads. But
Teresa, you hit on really another interesting point that I didn't raise about the legislation that was passed last night, is that there is another element of the bill that prohibits the sale of Americans' personal data to foreign entities. I haven't dug in enough to it, but I want to flag that to come back to at some point in one of the future shows, because that is incredibly important to us. And part
but
of the
can they do it though? That's what I listened to a hearing on this. But can they? I'm sorry. The expert.
No,
I try to learn about this because I think this data brokering, people have no idea how much of their private lives are being sold.
It's the most valuable commodity in the world.
Well, and we need to have a lot more conversation on this as a society, because even the state of New York, I understand why we need to have slower speeds in work zones. I disagree with the idea of a camera system taking pictures and then sending people bills. I think this is a slippery slope that we need to have more conversation on.
Right.
Well, let's have conversation about
another
topic.
Fran Berman. We need you. This is what Professor Fran Berman, this is what she's been doing for years.
We actually have this speeding ticketing system all over Europe. You get photographed, and the entire European Union has data that links your license plate to your home address, and you get your bill in the mail.
Yeah. This New York Times story that on how it happened to me, the story about GM Connect. I mean, they had data about this family, how long they drove, where they drove to, and how often they used the pedal and the brake and their turn signals. Because they didn't know. They signed off. They signed off on an agreement that they didn't know they were signing off on. And this woman was a person who said she reads the agreements. I read the agreements. Every time I see you have a right third parties, you're giving away your right for third parties.
Shouldn't you still be reading it?
No,
they're long.
You should read these things. They're amazing what you're giving up. No one does.
And they also collapsed her driving with her husband's driving, and it became one person, the husband was simply identified as the main owner, and then that data was combined, and that's how, because of their
insurance,
the extensive driving and the use of the brake pedals, their insurance went way up. And I'm thinking, thankfully, I drive a stick shift. They can't get me on these things.
Although there was another interesting part of the story, and I really urge people to read this article.
New York Times. It happened to me.
A person took his Cadillac onto a track so that he could drive fast. That was triggered, and it triggered like a $5,000 increase into his car insurance. And again, we as a society need to have conversations about this, because if you're going to do this, if you have a smart fridge that's actually monitoring how much ice cream you buy, and they say, well, Bob, you're overweight, therefore your health insurance should go up, this is an insidious slope that will erode our freedoms.
Door cameras.
Right. It's scary. Like how much access we allow
Alexa
in your house. It's scary. I would never want
it.
That. They're
unplug
just
it.
Monitoring everything you do.
All right, listen, we're all a little older. I didn't say old. I said older. And I don't think we're getting that feeling from a lot of the younger people. They see it as just part of the sea they swim in. Are you kidding? My identity's everywhere. I think it's a ho-hum for a lot of people. Yeah. Give me my TikTok. I don't care.
And then it was just a huge data breach in the health records, major health records.
Yeah.
Right. You know, a huge data breach. Anyway.
Well, let's...
I'm an old person. I can't stand it. I want to go to the Adirondacks off the grid.
Let's go to a non-controversial topic, shall we?
Okay.
Tennessee lawmakers passed bill to allow armed teachers a year after deadly Nashville shooting. Tennessee Republican lawmakers passed a bill that would let some teachers and staff carry concealed handguns on public school grounds. If Republican Governor Bill Lee signs the bill into law, it would be the biggest expansion of gun access in the state since last year's deadly shooting at a private elementary school in Nashville. Protesters loudly chanted, "Blood on your hands," after Tuesday's vote, leading the House Speaker to order the galleries cleared.
All I can say is the moment teachers start carrying guns or on campuses or anywhere like that, I'm done. I'm filing my retirement papers. That is the scariest thing ever.
It's this population that I don't want to see carrying guns. It's teachers. I also think that this is just another example of the so-called political leadership punting on a really hard issue. This doesn't address the issue. And I was thinking about it, and you know, teachers are doing, we're asking teachers and educators to do so much more than we've ever asked them to do in the past.
Absolutely.
While we want to pay them less, and while we want to throw stones at their capabilities. But the idea that now that they're going to be responsible to make life and death decision, okay, that we've seen how hard it is. If you think about the Uvalde situation, those were trained police officers who made the wrong decision. And now you're going to expect teachers to do the same thing. That's moral cowardice, David. That's all that is moral cowardice from the heart of Tennessee.
That's Bob Griffin. We've been speaking with Teresa Bourgeois, Vera Acarius-Kelly. I've gotten so involved in the discussion, I've gone a little long. That's going to be it. Panel at WAMC.org is how you can communicate with us. Thank you all for being here for the discussion today. More Roundtable next.